A lot of this inflated valuation expectation is driven from their investors. They're doing their companies a disservice if they're really getting them into a point where they have less than 24 months of runway. When I first moved to Nigeria, and Dunlady took me to just about every single meeting with him. Part of it was he wanted to show that they were a big, fancy private equity firm that could afford to have white Americans on their investment team. The sense of community in Lagos is bar none. By the way, I grew up in a town of about 100 people. It's the same sort of community feeling, even though I live in one of the world's megacities.
Hello, Internet, and welcome to the first episode of the Radicap podcast. My name is Kian, and I'm a partner at Radicap, the global fintech and climate fund. In this episode, we'll be sitting down with Lexi Nowicki, an iconic figure of the African tech scene, being an early investor in Flutterwave and Paystack. Lexi is a GP at Norsecon 22, which recently announced the final closing of their $200 million fund, the second largest in Africa. In this episode, we'll be mentioning different companies, including Sabi and Shara. I've included links in the description for full context. And without further ado, let's get into it. Lexi, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cool. So many questions. So first, quickly, you're a GP at Norsecon 22, saving the growth stage landscape in Africa. You just finished raising $200 million in the hardest time possible. How can someone pitch LPs telling them, hey, we're going to go to the hardest geography in the hardest time, buy at growth stage and hope for multi-billion dollar returns? How was the approach?
Yeah, there was a little bit of method to the madness. First of all, I think it was because we are so commercially minded, we knew we wanted to come to market with an LP base that was aligned with that and could bring an additional value to what we were building to our platform. Before we brought in the typical funders like the development finance institutions, we wanted to firmly already have a really good head start. We were very fortunate that we had built a relationship with Nicholas Otterberth and Hans Otterling, who wanted to back an Africa-focused fund with the Norsecon Foundation and Hans individually. We put the workings together. They were essentially the founders of this platform because they gave us the working capital to get our team going and to really hit the road running. But they also opened up their incredible network of successful founders out of the Nordics. These were founders that had built multi-billion dollar companies themselves, the founders of Delivery Hero, of Skype, of King. These founders were like, look, I know the European market, I know the American market, but I have no connection to this massive opportunity in Africa. I don't know the risks. I don't know the companies that are out there. For them, this was a bit of learning to get involved. But it was also, for some, they'd actually said it's actually an opportunity for them to scout out acquisition targets themselves. They were really looking at it as not just a way to, as investors, realize a nice commercial return, but very strategic in other senses too. We were able to come out with that initial $75 million from over 30 unicorn founders from across the world, a couple of those African, but mostly out of the Nordics.
Yeah. I'm assuming once you have that first nucleus of LPs, everyone follows, right?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely makes it easier. And it makes it easier in terms of negotiation on terms as well. But the profile of the LPs added a lot of credibility. We then had, of course, some backings of the development finance institutions, but we also had two commercial banks back us. One of those is SEB, other is Standard Bank here in South Africa, and some other big institutional investors. I think for what is essentially a first-time fund, because it's the first time these three GPs came together, we were able to lend a lot of credibility around not only the three partners, but this institution that we'd built around us to support us through this.
And I'm curious, how do you do the pricing? I would assume that growth stage founders are disconnected and they want to raise at $600 million and $800 million. So how do you tell them, hey, this whole $600 million story is gone and you have to just reset your own expectations? Did you have this conversation?
That conversation all the time. And I would say, especially in Nigeria, it doesn't seem to have adjusted very much yet. I think Egypt has absolutely adjusted on pricing, and Kenya and South Africa probably weren't as inflated to begin with, but Nigeria is still at the point where it's settling, but certainly hasn't landed. I am concerned because I think Nigerian founders are incredibly bold and optimistic and tend to think that they can survive anything and the capital is right around the corner, the market will recover in the next month or so, and we're just a long ways away from that. So I am concerned that they'll run their business until they have no cash left. We show them how we're coming to our valuation, and we provide data on global market comps and sometimes anonymized local African comps so they can actually see that we're not just pulling numbers out of thin air and we're not just trying a tough negotiating tactic. This is where reality is. We say, look, if this is where you want to raise at, these are the numbers that we want to see from you. If you think they're achievable, then great. We'll come back and we'll discuss. A lot of times I have to hear this from the overall market, not just us. And I think a lot of founders will, rather than tell them that it's a pricing issue, just not even respond, just shut down the conversation. But I would say another big problem is a lot of this inflated valuation expectation is driven from their investors as well. Investors don't want to write things down. They want to write things up. And they're doing their companies a disservice if they're really getting them into a point where they have less than 24 months of runway, right? And yeah, so that's a tough conversation as well.
I would guess that you have kind of two buckets of deals in your pipeline. The first one are relatively clean deals, Series A companies that are growing and coming to you. But you also have the other ones, which is it's a mess in terms of cap table and recap, and you have to clean that up and you have to do secondaries. There is real work to do, even on the governance side, to clean everything up.
Yeah.
And that just requires way more work, but also the opportunity might be massive because the company has more traction, has been there for longer. They just need a growth partner to re-put it on the right trajectory. So yeah. Do you shy away from those kind of deals?
No, but you're right. Sometimes they can be so messy because over this period, especially when you're in a cycle where it's bridge after bridge, these founders are piling safes on top of each other and they don't even understand what their cap table looks like anymore. And it gets quite complicated. There's certainly been an overuse of safes in this market to a detriment to founders more than anybody else. But yes, we are absolutely willing to roll our sleeves up. We are willing to help them structure some of these secondary transactions. And we're also happy to participate in secondary transactions as well, especially if we're investing in the primary. One thing that we have seen work well is, especially now in a market where there is a lot of risk and failure and some of these constraints on capital, is having the company actually buy back some of those shares and reissue in more senior on the pref stack. We have also, in one case, but we probably will do it in a second case that we're talking about right now, we've also put together not only an ESOP top-up, which is normal, but pretty generous way for the founder to recoup equity themselves through meeting certain KPIs. But instead of KPIs, because we actually thought what would keep us more in line was the valuation of the company. So if certain targets are met, which we both think are achievable on the valuation side, the founder should be able to recoup quite a bit of equity.
And does that happen at the expense of the early angel investors and employees that get wiped out?
It doesn't happen at the expense of anybody disequally. So we're all being diluted with that.
Makes sense. You mentioned value add at the beginning. I'm curious, when you get to a company that is already in our pre-seed terms massive and they're already multi-market, what can you help them with?
The value add is definitely very different at the growth stage. It falls into two primary buckets. One is being a trust agent. That can be anything from helping bridge conversations with major corporate clients to global investors, and I would say talent, especially when they're at a point when they're looking for best-in-class global talent. If you're a Nigerian founder, frankly, a lot of people have bias against that and think that there's a lot of risk involved. So we can help support and be that trust agent in a lot of these conversations. The second major bucket is around governance, and it's not always the most popular topic. We prefer to call it business integrity, because really what we're trying to do is help the companies build in systems and processes for scale, but also to protect the platform. So it's policies, it's licensing and certifications. It's, of course, setting up your board structure and everything on the corporate side that you need to have really properly formed. But it depends on the stage of the company. So this is important starting at A, going all the way to C. Then we're thinking about what needs to actually be put in place and done for a successful IPO, for example. Even if that's not the expected exit that we want, we're thinking about that readiness because that's also what acquirers will want to see. We have one case now where the company is an incredible company, profitable, generating a lot of cash. They don't need investment capital. But what they do need is somebody that's been through this whole exit process to help them make their company a top-tier company, so an acquisition will be seamless.
Nice.
They don't want a potential acquirer to come in, start getting nervous because not everything is in order, and walk away. So that's what we're helping support them with. And this is the value add that's more important at the growth stage, for sure.
That's awesome. From what I see, usually when these companies reach Series B, they need a lot of debt
usually, and they want to unlock it and preferably be cheap. And if IFC is not there, then, you know, you have the lendables, but it's expensive and USD denominated. Have you seen a lot of demand on the debt side,
yeah,
whether in your portfolio or in the companies that you speak to? And who's going to provide all this debt? Because I don't seem to see enough supply for that. So why doesn't Norskan actually create the venture debt side of it?
Maybe a future fund. Let's work on this one first. Yeah, you're totally right. Embedded finance, access to credit, the debt side, it is hugely needed for the success of many of these ventures, and it inhibits scale for a lot of them. Nigeria is probably the best market in Africa, where a lot of traditional financial institutions, certainly some family offices, some merchant banks have really become quite active in facilitating a lot of these debts for local companies. In many cases, the company will take their international debt capital from IFC or DFC or whoever it is and put it as collateral to access these local currency lines. And that's really what you want to see. I understand some of the DFIs are actually looking at setting up local currency vehicles as well, which should be very helpful. I just learned of a couple companies doing it in Egypt with some traditional banks. So that's starting to hopefully open up.
Nice.
I think the South Africa and Kenya markets are still extremely conservative, but that is a massive opportunity for all of these financial institutions and microfinance banks to really leverage the general ecosystem. Also, the revenue-based financing model, I think, has a massive place on the African continent, and firms like Untapped are doing a great job there. That's a big opportunity, I think, for anybody to really unlock.
I would love to talk financial services and your thesis in it, given Rallycap's DNA. Did you have a specific thesis per sector, and what was the one for financial services? And I don't know how comfortable you're sharing about Shara, but why you made that choice? Why do you think Shara has a real chance of being the counterbalance to M-Pesa?
Yeah, we absolutely do think that. Look, how we thought about financial services certainly varies by market quite significantly. And I think it'll be flexible and probably readjusted over time. But how we tackle a vertical is we look at all of the subsectors within it. And as a team, talk about our ecosystems as a whole. Is this problem of insurtech brokerage a big enough problem in a market individually? Does it have to be Pan-African in nature? Are there buyers there? And then we boil it down to the subsectors that we're really excited about. And I think that will very much change over time. Within financial services, the ones now that I think we've spent a lot of time on are embedded finance, but that certainly has a one leg in financial services and the other in market enablement, which is our other major vertical. Identity, which we've done an investment in Smile ID. I think that overall, the infrastructure needs there to verify the users that you're onboarding in your system, and fraud prevention is another big theme that we are absolutely watching. There's other solutions around that other than identity as well. Business to business transactions, I would say, especially in mid-market setting, and cross-border transactions, more on a B2B side than a B2C side. Those are the verticals we're really focusing our energy on. Some of those are already quite developed in South Africa. Payments is certainly quite developed in Nigeria as well. But ultimately, we think across all of these verticals that they'll probably be pretty Pan-African on the fintech side. And we want models that have a very sticky customer base where they can leverage off of clients to jump from one market to another, but where they have a strong moat in market to also really defend their position. And that brings me to Shara. What Shara is doing, which is a little bit different than a lot of the neobank plays we've seen in East Africa, is they're approaching the consumer, but they're doing it through relationships with the merchant. Inherently, these merchants have built relationships with their customers. They know their customers. They know their profile. They know what they're buying. Enabling those merchants to on-bank these end consumers and be financially incentivized on the success of those consumers is an interesting thesis. But I also love that they're going to be fully licensed. And that unlocks a huge opportunity for them to actually take deposits and become not only a neobank with strong economics, but somebody that can really challenge M-Pesa. So we see them as being able to provide free transactions across the board and really being able to be this platform that can, for once, unseat the big behemoth that has taken over the East Africa payment rails.
You mentioned the verticals that you're excited about in fintech. Are there other verticals or models that you think were overfunded or you were always skeptical about and you think that enough playing around those, we just know it doesn't work, it doesn't scale, let's move on, let's put money elsewhere?
The two areas that I have never had a strong thesis around were simple reconciliation products or companies where this was their only product. I do think reconciliation can be a tool to unlock data and hopefully keep a sticky customer base. But as a one-hit wonder, that's not something that ever excited me. I also think that brokerage in most markets across Africa, I don't think that the customer segment or the market size is large enough at this point in most Africa regions. If you can actually prove that brokerage can be a starting point for savings and layering on additional financial products, then I think it can possibly get interesting. But I also don't see massive barriers to entry in the brokerage space. And so that's a space that hasn't really excited me very much as well. Now, all of the other sectors that I think have been overdone, so to speak, neobanking, payments, I actually don't think that they are at all. I think there is so much to be done in those spaces still. And we've seen only a handful of success stories. There's one money point. There should be 10, and they're still coming. It's not always a first mover, winner takes all sort of thing. And I think we'll see a lot of those big success stories start to unlock markets within those same spaces where we've already seen a lot of verticals.
I'm curious about your read on Sabi, because there's a whole debate about this whole asset light model, asset heavy model, and then you have all these different experiments from the Trade Depot to Wasoko, Maxab, and everything in between. Also, most founders in the early days were using Udaan in India as the example, and they were getting inspired from it. But even Udaan, not sure how well of a model it turned out to be. It's a very polarizing topic.
Yeah.
A lot of people are really in it and big believers, and a lot of they're like, no way, you cannot make money out of moving goods. What is your thesis investing in Sabi, and how do you think that model could work at scale profitably and sustainably?
I actually think that the market misunderstands Sabi a lot, and part of that is probably engineered from the Sabi side and them protecting how they see their vision for the future and what they want the future to become. So hope I'm not dropping any trade secrets here. But Sabi, first of all, their customer is not the informal merchant. Their customer is the wholesaler, the distributor, the manufacturer. It's these much bigger enterprises that run in a very data light, paper-driven world. It's largely driven by relationships, phone calls, and not a lot of information in that ecosystem, and it's very inefficient. What Sabi is trying to do, well, what they are doing, they have certainly reached product market fit, is they are essentially several marketplaces put together to enable a platform for those manufacturers to operate much more efficiently and source, sell, finance, manage logistics. One of those avenues is selling goods. They want to sell their goods across borders and exports, being able to enable connection to those buyers, tracking and tracing the goods, making sure they get there. They want to enable selling into the informal market and to middlemen and managing those logistics and the pricing to enable that as well. But look, pretty soon, even a Trade Depot or an Omnibiz will be able to list on the Sabi platform. And they want that to happen because they want price discovery, because that's not their core business. They actually want data and volumes to go through there, but they're just trying to get an avenue to provide a full suite of value for that wholesaler manufacturer more than anything else. And within that, be able to provide financial solutions to them and, of course, much more efficient logistics and trade.
Is the end goal the financing?
Well, I would say the end goal is expanding margin and take rate. A piece of that is absolutely financing. But it's also understanding very closely where you can capture value and what products margin sits at. And in a lot of cases, it's not those fast-moving consumer goods that you talk about. But a wholesaler and distributor still needs that avenue if you don't want them to eat their lunch elsewhere.
Yeah, and then maybe talking about you more personally, you live in Lagos still, and it's been, what, 10 years now?
Yeah. I think we're going on 11.
Yeah. People just don't understand. I mean, this is your time.
Neither do my parents.
So even Nigerian friends, even most of Nigerians around, are having a hard time with their own country, and you're there, you seem to be happy for over a decade. How do you keep sane, and what's grounding you? What do you like?
So when I first moved to Nigeria, I initially moved there to join a firm called Varad Capital, who is still there, quite successful, run by Dunlady Ryan. And Dunlady, I remember, took me to just about every single meeting with him on that first year or so. Part of it was he wanted to show that they were a big, fancy private equity firm that could afford to have white Americans on their investment team. But for me, I learned a lot from that time period. At the beginning, it was like this excitement of adjusting and learning a new culture and figuring out the puzzle of how things work. The first 2 years, I barely traveled out at all. I think that landing hard and landing seriously was a big part of my longer term success there, because I built this infrastructure around me, that I was able to have a sanctuary and a city of chaos. I built a solid community. My best friends, shout out, no new friends. They were my friends when I first moved there. They're still my extremely close friends. And the sense of community in Lagos is bar none. It's like you live in a small, by the way, I grew up in a town of about 100 people. It's the same sort of community feeling, even though I live in one of the world's mega cities. And I never had that sense of community in New York or in Washington, D.C. or Boston, any of these other big cities that I ever lived in. But I have it in Nigeria. And I actually think part of the reason why there is such a strong sense of community is because we are dealing with hard things every day. It's a hard place to live. It's a hard place to do business. And you need to have your friends or your family there. So yeah, I'll try and then, not to get teary eyed. But yes, I have it. I do absolutely love it.
When I met you first time, like, you were at Singularity, repping, doing your things. I think you did Paystack and Flutterwave. That was like, oh, that woman, she did both. And then you did Acuity, and all of that was early stage. And now you're shifting to the list. How do you rewire your brain so that you stop thinking like an early stage investor?
It is very, very hard. And I will say the hardest thing for me that I didn't understand this would be such a challenge is when you're an investor and you're on a deal, you know the founder so well, you're spending lots of time with them. This is a team that can execute on this. And if that team aligns with the big market opportunity and their customers like their product, everything fits together nicely, right? Mm. But you tell that story to your IC and they're like, oh, but what's up with this growth number? It hasn't been consistently amazing every single period. And explain the Naira, everything is the Naira, the election. But it's so hard to tell a story that you really feel because you are spending hours, days. Some of these founders I've had relationships with for years. Yeah. And to boil that down in a 15-minute IC conversation, no matter how passionate I am about it and how much I believe in it, it's really hard to get that story across. And ultimately, when your investment committee is looking at product market fit, exit multiples, and those are the two numbers, all of that other stuff is just noise to them. It's hard to really portray it in a concise story of what this deal is going to be. It's going to be a 10Xer, but you can't just say, because I believe it. Yeah. And I think at the early stage, you can make a lot more of those swings because of what you know as a GP. So yeah, that part is hard. I also think you get to a point in growth stage where it becomes a lot more finance and squeezing out efficiency and making sure you don't focus efforts on the wrong things, whereas early stage, you're able to experiment around different things. And that should be a culture of the company. But it becomes less psychological, which it probably is in the early stage, and more around finance and the numbers and analytical in the growth stage. So yet to be seen if I can do it. But yeah, I certainly hope so. And I think at least by the Series A stage, a lot of these companies should still be able to have kind of that visionary view as long as the numbers line up at least.
Yeah, cool. So just to wrap up the interview, I wanted to say that you represent a lot of hope for early stage founders and investors like us. For us, our exit strategy is Norskan is going to buy us out. So thank you for doing what you're doing. And we look forward to seeing you in our portfolio more.
Yeah, me too. Thanks. Thank you so much.
Cool.
That was fun.